Hello and welcome back to another episode of Many Moons Ago, a podcast by Do History. Today we're joined by the authors of In Spanish Trenches, The Minds and Deeds of the Irish Who Fought for the Republic in the Spanish Civil War, Barry McLaughlin and Emmett O'Connor. My name's Liam.
And I'm Isabel.
And let's just jump right into it.
Great. So just to get started, we'd love to hear about what inspired you to write this book.
Well, we got the idea in 1994 or 1995. Emmett and myself were in Moscow in the Comintern archive, you know, the Archive of the Commons International. And he was working on Ireland and I was working on Austrian communism. But, you know, this was a fantastic time. I mean, Russia was in bits. You know, there was terrible poverty. But, you know, it was a democracy and it was open, the archive. And they were very forthcoming in those days. That didn't last very long. It only lasted about 5 years. And we also, you know, just had a quick look at the Irish files, you know, the personal files in Opus 6 of Fund 545. And then, you know, we were doing other things. And in 6 years ago, I wrote a book about the Limerick fellas in the International Brigades. And afterwards, we started going to Spain together, Emmett, myself, and two English friends, Richard Baxel, who is also an historian of the International Brigades, and John Halstead, who's the chairman of the British Labour History Society. So we visited all the battlefields, and then, you know, I got it into my head to learn very basic Spanish and go to Spain and see what was in the archives. So I did that in 2017. So I began to write my parts in 2017. And, you know, between teaching and doing other things, you know, we got it finished. I think the book was finished the end of April 2020, just before Corona. So it's a pre-Corona book. So Emmett might like to say something here. Of course, I should also say I always admire these people, you know. And I knew some of them very well. I knew Bob Doyle, who was a great character. First time I met him in North London, he wanted me to smoke dope with him. And I said, I wasn't into dope, Bob. Let's go down to the pub. And we drank pints of Guinness, surrounded by Irish men in Wellington boots in the building site. And of course, I knew Peter's father, I know Emmett's father, Peter, and I knew Austrian. I had one very close friend here who since died, unfortunately. He was the youngest in the international, among the Austrians in the International Brigades, Hans Landau. He was only 16 when he went to Spain. So, you know, the interest was always there. It was just a matter of getting time to work it out and then to work out, you know, who's going to write what chapter and discuss everything in detail. And, you know, Emmett, I went to Spain. I went to Germany. I went to Berlin to look at the stuff on Frank Ryan. And Emmett went to Kew. And both of us, you know, researched in Dublin, the National Archives, National Library. So that was it. And it was finished, as I said, just over a year ago. And it takes a long while because, you know, a book is sent out to referees. They're called readers, I think, which is a bit confusing. I call them referees. I think that's the old term. And of course, they're very busy. And they come back within 3 months, and then some of them, if they can be troublesome, they suggest lots of changes. But we were lucky with our referees, and they were just minor things.
So it seems like there was a lot of interest in Spain during this period. Why did the Republicans' fight appeal so much to Irish people?
Yeah. The war made a huge impact on Ireland, especially I think between July 1936 and July 1937. And it was fueled initially by the atrocity stories coming back So, you know, it was a case of Catholic Ireland identifying with Catholic Spain, and then liberals and radical Ireland, radicals in Ireland responding to that and saying, you know, you're getting the wrong end of the story. It's really a story of democracy against fascism, and trying to counter that in propaganda terms, then gradually being drawn into, sending men to Spain to fight. And that led to the emergence of what became called the Connolly Column. Well, that term wasn't used until the 1970s as a kind of blanket term for all of the Irish who fought in Spain. But there was also, I think, a concern that Ireland might go fascist, that when what the Comintern called O'Duffy's fascist bravos returned from Spain as heroes, you know, that these would sort of electrify the country, and maybe there'd be a big sort of victory for Fine Gael in the next elections in July 1937. And when that didn't happen, I think people started to relax a bit, and the sort of interest in Spain kind of eased off a bit. The Catholic Church, I think, was a bit embarrassed by how badly the O'Duffy's Irish Brigade had performed. There was, on the other side, on the Republican side, I think there was a growing feeling by the late summer of 1937 that Franco was going to win in the end, and it was a kind of a lost cause. So, you know, the passions cooled a bit. But there is this perception, I think, among academic historians especially, that Ireland was, you know, very isolated before we joined the European Union. Whereas I would argue that we're one of the most globalized countries in the world since the late 18th century, at least. You know, partly because of the fact that we were originally English-speaking, very high rate of emigration, part of the two big international agencies, the British Empire and the Catholic Church. So there was always this awareness. You read provincial newspapers in Ireland in 1936, 37, they've got pictures of the Spanish Civil War, they've got regular coverage of the Spanish Civil War. There was a huge interest in events in Europe. So it's no surprise, really, that there was such passionate engagement of Ireland with Spain in 1936-1937.
So what would you say motivated ordinary Irishmen to go to Spain to fight?
Yeah, I think initially, well, you two currents, you had the main kind of pillars of the Connolly Column, as it became, were the Communist Party of Ireland and the Republican Congress. Now, the Communist Party of Ireland would, of course, was following the Comintern line, so they would eventually have gotten involved to some degree. In any case, I think the Republican Congress was motivated more by reacting to O'Duffy and a feeling that there was a need for a riposte to O'Duffy and a need to counter this impression that all of Ireland was Catholic and fascist. So undoubtedly, the campaigns in favour of Franco and the activities of people like O'Duffy and in the press and in the pulpit, you know, were a major factor in the motivation behind people like Frank Ryan going to Spain.
Yeah, you also had, of course, there's an important proviso, I suppose you could say, or qualification to that, is that most Irish men who went to fight in Spain on the side of the Republic didn't come directly from Ireland, or didn't come direct from Ireland. They came from Britain, most of them, or the United States, or Canada. About 30 came from Canada, and even two or three from Australia. So I think this is it. You have a common, there's a common thing here of Irish men being, or women, we're talking about men, being politicized abroad. You can imagine yourself from a sort of a rural background, and you land in New York and you get this terrible job on the subways. And then you organize the Transport Workers Union, like Mike Quill, who's a kind of a Frank Ryan character, a left-wing Republican from Kerry, became a major figure in modern American history. So he was one who became, from a rural background, who became radicalized in America. And like Frank Ryan, he never joined the Communist Party. He remained a kind of a Connollyite Republican. So there were many people like him, Jim Wolfe as well. He went to Canada. He was in County Limerick, another IRA man. So you have people like that. And then you have people maybe younger, were born about 1910 and went to work in England. And it was a time of, the Great Depression and the hunger marches and Mosley. There were people, Irish people, who went to Spain to fight, but they didn't really know who Frank Ryan was. So that's the other side of it. The Irish who were radicalized abroad.
So they were pretty scattered throughout the international brigades. There wasn't a distinct Irish unit.
Originally the idea was there would be one. Harry Pollitt, he wrote to fairly early on, I think. He said that the Irish want a separate unit, but they just weren't enough. You can't have a company. First of all, the whole idea of having a national unit really is arguably against Comintern and anti-fascist policies, because we're all in this together, we're anti-fascists. And I mean, if there had been 600 Irishmen, they might have at one stage formed a battalion, but there was never, the 250, there were never enough in the Irish in the brigades to form a company, even a company which would be about 120 men. And that would have led to all kinds of complications, because then you have the Welsh would say, we want a company. And then you'd have the Scots. So it was, the idea was dropped after an initial row with the British. It was dropped. And from mid-1937 onwards, all the Irish who arrived from Britain or Ireland in Spain, to Spain, when they arrived there, they joined the British Battalion.
So was there a sort of conflict between British officers and Irishmen who may have even in past years fought against the British? Was there any sort of conflict between them?
Yeah, well, some say there was, with regard to the question of policy on nationalities, first of all, I think there was a tension between official international brigades policy, which was sort of pure internationalism in form, separate battalions only, as a matter of operational necessity. So you have, French speakers in one battalion, you've got German speakers in another battalion, just for reasons of, practical necessity. But on the other hand, if you look at the politics of the communist parties involved, certainly the CPGB, you can see it right from the beginning. They were always aware of how what was going on in Spain could be used as propaganda back home. And they were very concerned that there would be a British battalion. And there's even a letter from, I think it's Carrigan back to Pollitt saying, I'm going to stop sending men to the front until we in case it damages, our prospects of building up the numbers to have a British battalion. And Pollitt certainly understood the importance for recruitment in Ireland for having an Irish unit. And the Republican Congress leaders were keen that there would be an Irish unit. But at the same time, by January 1937, they realized that they just didn't have the numbers. And the best they could hope for would be to form a kind of subunit, a company or something like that, of Irishmen within the British battalion. Now, Frank Ryan was very keen that they should fight alongside the British, the better to win allies against British imperialism. He felt that fighting with the Americans was just pointless because it just didn't pay any dividends in respect of, the struggle in Ireland. But you had this mysterious meeting then called in mid-January in Madrigueras, the training base of the British Battalion, asking the Irish, do you want to stay in the British Battalion or do you want to go over to join the Americans who had just arrived or were just arriving at Villanueva de la Hara? So, who called that meeting was never very clear, but it's always certain that it was one of the British commissars. And why it was called is even more obscure. Now, some people say it was because of tension between the British and the Irish at rank and file level. Others say it was because of the way in which the Irish were treated by British officers. Others say it was because you had some black and tans in the command structure of the British battalion. But others say it was because the battalion was being reported back in the Daily Worker as a British battalion rather than an English-speaking battalion. But it seems to me that these are all attempts to find excuses for the decision of the Irish, or most of them anyway, to go over and join the Americans. There probably was some degree of tension. The veterans, I think, they're a bit divided on this. I mean, some say that there was chronic tension between the different nationalities. Others say, it wasn't such a big factor and it was played up and wasn't really all that important. But what seems to me to be very clear is that the commissars were very worried about the idea of a distinct Irish unit under the control of Frank Ryan, because he wasn't in the party. Now, they'd probably been a bit paranoid in that respect. It probably wouldn't have been a problem at all. But of course, they were anticipating problems when they were putting the battalion together. And I think that was the reason why they overreacted and they called this meeting. And tensions and divisions, which may well have been there, I think, were sort of played up and led to the Irish then voting, most of them to join the Americans. And to make the thing even kind of more complicated, some of those who voted to join the Americans stayed with the British battalion. And some of those who voted to stay with the British battalion went over and joined the Americans. So it's all very unclear. But almost all the Irish fought either in the British battalion or the Lincoln battalion then.
Yeah, that's a general question of national tensions in the international brigades. And the Russian advisors cottoned onto this fairly early. They were very critical about it. Seems to have been tension between the Italians and the Poles. And the big row was between the French and the Germans, because the Germans were very strong, the best troops, arguably. And Marty, André Marty, wanted to keep the French hegemony. So he kind of got rid of the German leadership in 1938. And had them expelled from the country. Then if you go down to a lower level, you've got volunteers from countries who want their own battalions. Like the Austrians had to fight against the Germans to get their battalion, the 12th of February battalion. And of course, the Canadians had to fight against Americans to get their battalion, the Mackenzie Papineau battalion. But I think in the end, these things were ironed out. And as regards the Irish-British row, I think it was due to the fact that the British commissars, as Emmett said, didn't want a unit in the British battalion controlled by Irish republicanism, by Irish republicans, although there's a contradiction here, because there's sort of dual membership, many of the leading people in Spain among the Irish were in both, were in the Communist Party of Ireland and were in the Republican Congress, but they all would have supported Frank Ryan. It's this problem did exist, but it's weakened the military value of the international brigades. I think far more worrying was the tension between communist field commanders and professional army officers on the Republican side.
So just to expand on something that was mentioned earlier, how did propaganda influence Irish opinion on the war?
Yeah, well, of course, the media at the time would have been the press to a lesser extent than radio, and also newsreels, which would have been shown in the cinemas. Now, the press in Ireland was almost entirely pro-Franco. There was a huge interest, as I say, in Spain. And I mean, all the main three Dublin dailies, the Independent, the Irish Press, and the Irish Times, they all sent correspondence to Spain. That was very unusual at the time. So the Independent in particular gave very regular coverage of anti-clericalism on the government side, as did the Irish News in Belfast. Probably the most balanced newspaper coverage would have been in Ireland at the time would have been found in the Unionist newspapers, because the Unionist papers didn't like either side. I mean, they didn't like the Communists, but they didn't like the Franco and the Catholics either. They tended to be more even-handed in their reportage and had a sort of plague on both their houses. So the Republican Congress people felt that they were really, beleaguered, and that the Irish people were just getting a very one-sided picture of what was going on in Spain. And they tried to counter that mainly through the newspaper, the Irish Democrat, which is set up as an anti-Franco paper. And also through things like the New Theatre Group and the Left Book Club, and by holding meetings and so on. Their argument really was to try and present the war as, you know, a fascist assault on democracy. And they play down the anti-clericalism on the government side, or you know, argued that you know, there were serious atrocities on the other side which were not being reported as well. And then you had some writers and so on, like Cate O'Brien, who were also and people like Mitchell, or I can't recall her first name.
Maureen Mitchell
wrote Storm Over Spain, yeah. So, you know, the intelligentsia in Britain tended to be overwhelmingly pro-Republic, and that was true to a lesser extent in Ireland. Another kind of side of the struggle, which is kind of overlooked really, is that kind of sub-team on the Republican side in Ireland was that you had a mobilization of liberal secular Ireland against, you know, what they would have seen as an oppressive secularism. And it was really the kind of first sort of fight back against clericalism in post-independent Ireland. And it was small, limited, but nonetheless it was there. And it echoed the kind of themes that came out again in the 1960s with the you know, the liberalization of Irish society in the 60s. You know. But it was very one-sided fight, because the main sort of vehicles of propaganda would have been, you know, in control of the church and the conservative politicians, big business, Irish Christian Front. So the Republican side were very much fighting, you know, with their backs to the wall.
There's another thing, another form of propaganda, if you like, was the radio, Radio Madrid. I think Frank Ryan spoken it three times. Paddy O'Dea, the commander of the British Battalion, spoke. And I think this was mentioned in the Irish press. You know, they listened to it. And it struck me, looking through the Irish press in those years, that they had big articles after a battle, you know. They would give the names of the Irish who were killed, and short biographies of the men. So, and then, of course, you had British newspapers in Ireland. So I think by mid-1937, you know, the Christian Front had more or less collapsed. The fascists had bombed Guernica. So it wasn't, and as Emmett said, the church had been embarrassed by O'Duffy's men coming home. So people were probably thinking more. If they did think about it at all, they probably thought it wasn't a black and white business. But I think as the war progressed, the interest waned, because, you know, a European war was coming up on the radar.
Yeah, it might also be mentioned that the pro-Republic propaganda emphasized two themes. One was that the Basques, and the fact that the Basques were a Catholic people who were fighting Franco with the support of their clergy. And the other was that Franco was making use of Moorish troops. So there was a lot of, you know, criticism of that, and the sort of hypocrisy of using Moorish troops to save Christian Spain and so on, you know. And some of that makes it maybe a bit uncomfortable reading today, you know, in the light of sort of current attitudes about race and ethnicity and so on. But I think you have to put it in context, and you have to represent the truth as it was, warts and all.
And then I'd say, what were the opinions of the political parties in Ireland? Like obviously Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Labour, did they have any particular affiliation with one of the sides in the Spanish Civil War?
Yeah, well, the Fine Gael would have been very, you know, gung-ho for Franco and wanted the Irish government to recognise the Franco regime immediately. Fianna Fáil was a bit more detached. I mean, De Valera wanted to pursue his policy of neutrality and played strictly by the rules of, you know, international diplomacy. So he didn't recognise Franco until 1939. And the Fianna Fáil party would have been, I suppose, largely pro-Franco, but there would have been a lot of more sympathy, I think, with the Republican side on the Fianna Fáil side. And you find more even-handed coverage in the Irish press, you know, whereas the Independent is very much totally pro-Franco. The Labour Party then just kind of ducked for cover. I mean, Labour felt that, you know, it was always kind of vulnerable to this argument, you know, that socialism was foreign and anti-Christian and so forth. And that if it took a stand on Spain, it would really be hammered by the right-wing reaction and could well split the party. So the strategy of the party leader, Bill Norton, was a very astute and clever political leader. And he was, you know, he's not so popular today because of his politics, but you have to kind of give him credit for his tactical ability. But his approach was, we just don't say anything about Spain. We're against all dictatorships of the right and of the left. And they brought out a pamphlet, the Labour Party brought out a pamphlet called Cemeteries of Liberty, Communist and Fascist Dictatorships, which condemned, you know, both fascism and Stalinism.
Going back a bit to the foundations of the International Brigades, was their formation really driven by the Comintern, or was it almost spontaneous?
Well, there were, of course, communists, foreign communists in Spain. Before the war broke out, there was a German emigre group, KPD, you know, German communist group. There were people there for the workers' Olympiad, and there was pressure, of course, from the communist parties in what was happening in Spain, especially from the French party. But initially, the Comintern wanted, you know, supplies sent, they wanted pilots sent, and the initial Soviet response was propaganda meetings, collecting foodstuffs, collecting money for Spain. And it wasn't until mid-September, it was late August, the Politburo decided to send military aid. And then about 2 weeks later, the Comintern met in several sittings and they decided to ask their affiliates, the communist parties, to send volunteers. So it was definitely driven by the Comintern. And it would have been very difficult to get to Spain and be admitted to the International Brigades if you didn't go through the system. That is, you went to Robson in London, in Lichfield Street, then you took then you went down to Dover or New Haven and you were quizzed by flat-footed special branch men and you told them a cock and bull story. And you had this weekend ticket, you see. I'm just going over for a dirty weekend, Sergeant. And then you arrived in Paris and you had an address and you were put in some dingy hotel. And then you were ferried down from Paris to Perpignan. Now, as long as the border was open, that was fine. You got the train then and you crossed the border. But I can't remember when it was first closed, the border. I think it was early 1937. So it meant that you had to climb the Pyrenees. Like when Frank Ryan went over in December with his lads, you know, about 15 of them, that was no problem. But when he went back to Spain in June 1937, and I think he remarks on it, he was pretty unfit and he declined the Pyrenees. It was pretty rough going. So, that was the system. And if you arrived in Spain without going through the system, you were open immediately to suspicion. You know, what are you doing here? Are you a spy? Are you an agent of British intelligence or whatever?
And then what was life like for the brigadiers in Spain?
Well, it was fairly rough. I mean, if you read, I spent a lot of time at the university talking about the First World War and the Second World War, and bringing students with Michael, my brother, and people from Ireland to battlefields of the First World War. So if you have a good idea of conditions on the Western Front of the First World War, you'd say, okay, the battles were horrific, but the soldiers were generally well looked after. The British soldiers, at least, they were well fed. They only spent, you know, generally two weeks in the front line, and then they were released into the back areas. You know, there was a roster system. They went through fairly good training, and none of that holds true for the International Brigades. I mean, the first crowd that went over they were thrown into battle without having fired a rifle beforehand. So they were massacred. The food situation, and this is something that I think in most books on the war hasn't been really explained in detail, and something I'm very interested in is there was a grave shortage of food in the Republican zone. Most of the wheat growing areas were outside, were in the Franco zone. So there was a food shortage. So I would say the international brigaders, also due to the non-intervention policies and the problems the Russians had getting supplies through, their arms weren't very good. They were badly fed. Their uniforms fell apart and losses were very high. I mean, losses among the Irish were 30% killed, fatalities. Now, in the First World War, I think the figure is 13% for men and officers killed in the British Army. So it's very high losses. So the international brigades were thrown in sort of as a shock troops, and conditions, I would argue, were far, far harder than they were in the, you know, in the First and Second World War.
You've mentioned that the Russian files released in the 1990s made lots of new information available that historians like yourselves have taken advantage of. Are there any aspects of the Spanish Civil War and Ireland's involvement in it that are of particular interest for future research?
Yeah, I mean, all these files from the Russian State Archive of Social and Political History, Raskaspi, they're all online, but it's all in Russian, you see. The finding aids are all in Russian, so most people don't know about it. And I found them a great help, especially Opus 3, which are, it's all about the, you know, the orders and the descriptions of the battles. And that's something, I mean, I downloaded thousands of pages. So I was able to fill out the gaps, you know, because you take one of the biggest battles of the war, Brunete. It was a horrific battle in heat of over 40 degrees. And most men have survived it. They couldn't give a coherent account of their stay in this cauldron of steel, as I call it. But then you look at the you know, brigade files, the battalion reports. And an interesting thing is that the British, there was a diary of the British battalion. Now, military historians will tell you the most, if you're inquiring into a unit, like let's say the Munster Fusiliers in the First World War, the first thing you have to look at is the battalion diary. And they're all in queue, of course, you know, and most of them are online now, I think. But the British Battalion, the diary of the British Battalion in the 15th International Brigade disappeared. I think it was used in 1938 by Bill Rust, who was the editor of the Daily Worker, and he'd been in Spain in that function as well, and he'd been CPGB representative. He probably used it to write the book, but then the battalion diary disappeared. So that would be a fantastic find if it turns up somewhere. Maybe it's in some Spanish military archive. Maybe it's in Avila. I suppose there's other things to look at, like supervision and discipline. This isn't often a popular subject among left-wing historians, you know. I mean, I'm quite shameless about this. You know, I just tell it as Emmett says, just tell it as it is. And there were many men in the British battalion who didn't like the rule of the commissars and, you know, didn't like their posts being censored. So, there's some things you could look at. I was saying to a friend of mine lately who's a writer, a very well-known writer here, Eric Hackle, and he's written a lot on Spain. He's a Hispanist. And I said, Eric, we could write the definitive story of the Austrians in the international brigades. And he was all, oh, his eyes lit up. And then I said, yeah, an awful lot of work because the files are in Moscow, but you know who would be interested? So there aren't many here in Austria interested in this. It's completely different in Ireland. I mean, I don't know, Emmett has counted them, I think. What is it, 40 memorials, is it, Emmett?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
40 memorials. And in Austria, there's one hidden in the central cemetery in Vienna. And down the road from me here, there's a block of flats named after my friend Hans Landauer. But the interest is, there wouldn't be great interest in it. Especially, you see, when the people themselves die off, the interest wanes, and it's a bit ironic in Ireland that the interest hasn't waned at all. And I think it's due to the fact as well that some see it as part of the struggle for freedom in Ireland, part of the Republican struggle. I don't mean being sort of pro-provisional IRA or anything like that, but see, it's probably seen in that general account of Irish history from 1798 onwards. I would imagine that would have fired the interest of people in Ireland to put up a memorial, although they would have had nothing to do with communist politics or anything like that. But they just thought this man like Kit Conway down in the Glen of Aherlow was a great fella, and he'd been in the IRA, and he'd been a commander in Spain. So I think that's the difference. So here, unfortunately, I suppose it was just over. You know, you have other historical events. You know, like the Holocaust, Second World War. You know, sort of over smothering it, whereas in Ireland. Which was neutral, of course, in the Second World War. You've got this this body of men who were sort of premature anti-fascists and kept this Republican ideal going, and died for it. So you could see it as a kind of a general commemoration or celebration, as Emmett says. You can't commemorate without celebrate. Can't commemorate without celebrating. So. Yeah, it's quite, I'm delighted, of course, that all this is happening in Ireland. And I'm surprised by it, I must say.
And then I say one of the most interesting or confusing chapters would be the story of Frank Ryan, spending so long in prison and then eventually dying in Dresden. Would you mind telling us a bit about him in particular?
Yeah, well, that was one of the first chapters I wrote was about Frank Ryan, you see, because I found his file... I found a file on him in Spanish National Archives. You know, it's full of letters of supplication and rejection. And then I got his trial file. So what really struck me and what shocked me really, and I think this is kind of, no reviewer has mentioned this. Why did Frank Ryan spend so long in jail? Well, one of the reasons was because his enemies in Ireland did for him. And he wasn't condemned for anything he did in Spain, because his prosecutors had no evidence or very, very little evidence of what he'd actually done in the brigades. So he was actually condemned for what he'd done in Ireland, allegedly had done in Ireland. And this was fed into the Francoist system by... O'Duffyites and right-wing journalists, and by a British diplomat. So I found that very interesting. As regards why did he go to Dresden? Well, it was clear in 1940 he was the only one left in Burgos prison, the only international left. The Americans had been let out. His friend Tom Jones from Wrexham had been released, and Franco obviously didn't want to release him. And he was in very poor health. He had heart insufficiency. He knew about this since the mid-30s because he collapsed in Dublin, and his brother in Yorkshire told him, you know, you've got a very high blood pressure. So his heart, I suppose he had a leaking heart, as we say. And, you know, he'd lost, I don't know how many kilos. So he looked like an old man in Burgos in 1940. And then the Germans came along. And I wrote, that's another discovery I made, that the German diplomats might have got him out, but that would have been a slow business. But it was the Abwehr in the end who got him out, because Canaris, the head of German Abwehr, German military intelligence, he'd spent the First World War in Madrid, so he spoke perfect Spanish. And he went directly to Franco and he said, we want this man for, you know, missions in Ireland. So what do you do if you're Frank Ryan, you're in a cell, all your pals have gone, you've got a very bad heart, you have to lie down most of the day. The war is going to go on, so you're not going to be released during the World War. And you get this offer, the Germans are going to come for you. And you imagine that your friends are behind it, Germans that you'd met in the 1930s in Dublin. So what do? You go along with it. And he did, but as I said in the book, the links between the IRA and the German state have been written about ad nauseam. There's about 6 or 7 books about this question. And nothing that we found in the archives, Foreign Office archives, Bureau Wesenmeier, he was his boss, Eduard Wesenmeier, because he said, no, the Foreign Office has taken over this case, these cases away from the Abwehr. So he was Frank Ryan's boss. Now, Frank Ryan would have written a few reports now and again. They didn't survive. And the ideas of, you know, sending him to Ireland after the first aborted attempt never came about for various reasons. One of them being that Frank Ryan was very sick from about 1942 onwards. You know, he had a heart, he had 2 strokes. And he died after the second one. He had rheumatism, he had a car accident, he had pneumonia. And anyway, the Germans weren't interested in Ireland anymore because it was the push east. So, you know, he just sort of, he was at a loose end. He was very bored, you know, that from people who knew him. And just his heart gave out. So if he had been released in, let's say, 1939, and had got back to Ireland before the Second World War broke out, because De Valera didn't want him released during the war because that would have led to all kinds of complications with the British. But let's say he'd been released before the Second World War broke out, he probably wouldn't have lived very long. There was no open heart surgery in those days.
Would you say that the international brigades were effective, and what kind of impact they make both in Spain as well as for the Irish people involved back in Ireland?
Well, I just say something here. I think they were effective troops. They held the line, and then they got more professional. They had a long, there were some great many volunteers who came over after July 37, and they were trained for about 6 months. They got really proper military training, and they didn't fire a shot then because they were captured in Aragon at the end of March 1938. They were, you know, sent to the front. So I think they were quite effective in the end. But as we say in the book, you know, they had no anti-tank guns anymore. They had very few grenades, very few aircraft, very few artillery pieces. So they were up against it. They were kind of cannon fodder at the end.
Yeah, I think they were particularly important in saving Madrid in the, you know, the early months of the war. And I mean, had Franco captured Madrid, I mean, that would have been a major advance on his part. You know? But in terms of the politics and the propaganda, they were hugely significant. I think, you know, they really helped to internationalize the struggle and to make it, you know, a worldwide political cause, and to hammer out the argument that you need to stop fascism, you know, at Madrid. And if you don't stop it at Madrid, you'll be fighting it in Prague or in Paris or in London, which of course proved to be the case.
And then what exactly was the legacy they left in Ireland?
I think there was a kind of a silence for about 30 years in Ireland, mainly because the people who kind of controlled the media and the public space in many ways would have been on the right, and they were, you know, embarrassed by their involvement with Spain. Particularly, I think, when, you know, fascism turned out to be such a disaster for Europe in the 1940s. You know, in the 1930s, a lot of people saw fascism as a very efficient way of doing things and as the future. And I think in Ireland, and this is something which is probably not sufficiently appreciated, but the collapse of Mussolini's Italy, I think, was a big blow to any kind of sympathizers with fascism in Ireland, because they tended to be more inspired by Mussolini than by Hitler. And the collapse of Mussolini's Italy showed how inefficient the whole system was, and really helped to discredit it in that respect. And then, of course, once they opened the concentration camps, people could see the full horrors of fascism. So those who had supported Franco tended to be pretty quiet about it. Those who were against Franco didn't feel they could really speak out until the 1980s, when you had a real kind of secularism kicking in and a revival of interest. And the international brigaders from Ireland were now seen as forerunners of modern, liberal, secular, pluralist Ireland, who fought the good fight in 1936, not just in Spain, but in Ireland too. And I think it was a sense of guilt, maybe, that they hadn't been recognised and celebrated before. So that, I think, partly explains the enthusiasm with which all of these memorials were put up. And I think there was also, they became subsumed into the history wars, as they're called. And this this kind of conflict that goes on, you know, over celebration and over how we remember history, which is so very topical in Ireland. But for people in the liberal sphere and people on the left, I think they'll always be regarded, you know, as a sort of great shining light of, progressive thought and action in Irish history.